Wow, we've just discovered the tone button. John.
Fantastic. Last week, I was so hissy. One of your inputs is completely f***.
You're such a c***.
Welcome to episode 4 of The Purple Fringe, the show where we discuss the high end of the low end digital media production equipment.
Well, here we are back again, John, with your impeccable week you've had. Have you gone since the last show?
Not too bad, Chris. Yourself? You're sounding a bit under the weather.
A little bit. I partied a little bit too hard, and then I've been on set for 4 days. So just that thing of it's been brutal heat in Australia recently, so especially down in Melbourne. So we've been running around with carts full of gear, and one of those locations where there's a lot of A to B, and we've got to use service ramps. Because funnily enough, you can't take a trolley up and down staircases. So.
Well, you can take them down, just not up.
Yeah, and you might not be able to use everything once it's come down. But yeah, it's been a fun week for me. A lot of learning. However many years it is on, you still learn something for every shoot. So
indeed.
We had a lot of fun with shadows and gradients on walls. That's been my
week. Of course. Shadows and gradients on walls. All right. Well, today we've got a few things to chat about, which have been happening in the world of media production. We'll kick off with one of the lesser announcements that's happened over the last couple of weeks, and that is Canon releasing the new 1300D.
The Rebel.
Well, in this country, the 1300D. In the US, the Rebel T6. In Japan, I think it was the KISS. Don't know what version of the KISS they're up to, but I think it was always called the KISS in Japan. Someone can correct me if I'm wrong there. It's their entry-level camera. And look, it's nothing special, and this upgrade isn't all that amazing. In fact, it's basically the 1200D, and they've slightly upgraded the processor, and they've added Wi-Fi and NFC. So I think they're aiming for people that might be coming from, you know, the Instagram verse, where they take it on their phone and upload it straight away, and now they can take it on an SLR, transfer it to their phone, and upload it right away. Or at least that seems to be what they're going for, because I'm not sure why else you'd add the Wi-Fi and NFC to such an entry-level camera. So, I don't know, I'm not that excited by this particular announcement, Chris.
I mean, it's not a video camera anyway, but it shoots your 1080 P video, still line skip, so you know you're not going to get the best quality video out of it. Look, as a point and shoot, look, it's the glass you put on the front of it. This applies to a lot of cameras, and if you've got access to a couple of bits of nice glass, even the entry level, the Canon 1.8, I think it is 50mm, which sort of translates to a sort of nice portrait lens.
Yeah, but with the crop 80-ish. Sensor ish.
Yeah.
Mills, yeah.
So for that, and for shooting low light, for shooting events and things like that, and being able to upload straight from a party or an events thing, you know, and get your shot straight up there.
Yeah, look, it might be good if you're at a pub or something.
It's more a consumer camera. I mean, anything, the features you get as soon as you start stepping up from here are very handy.
Yeah. Although at this stage, for the money, I reckon Sony is releasing some more interesting things.
Sony are certainly getting on that bandwagon with their, you're thinking of their 6300.
Yeah, look, it's a different camera, obviously, a much different camera, but
I would argue it's more handy, though. It's smaller, form factor just fits.
Yeah.
You know, and it's mirrorless, and I honestly think the days of the 1200, 1300 sort of series are over. People want something smaller with the same functionality.
Yeah, look, it doesn't bode well, I think, for the category. I think the bigger SLRs are really just going to return to where they came from, and that's to the pros who are happy to lug around those heavy bodies and heavy lenses, and that revolution where normal mums and dads started buying SLRs because they thought it would give them better photos. I think that's going to go away, and they'll maybe go to the mirrorless or back to, well, probably go back to phones now, I suppose.
Yeah, there's a lot of good low light developments happening with phones, and very clever multi-exposure adding of the pictures after you've taken the photo to get your image, so you reduce the blur and motion blur and things like that. So,
well, rumours of dual lenses on the new iPhone when that comes out, so we'll see how we go there, but it's moving rapidly.
And talking of businesses that are moving rapidly, Panasonic have made a couple of rapid movements in the last few days.
Yeah, so they've released a new camera that's, I guess it's somewhat in the vein of the Sony Z150 we spoke about a couple of weeks ago, but it's definitely a different beast. Panasonic are just as bad as Sony with their model numbers. This is the AJ-PX230PJ, the PJ model. AVT Ultra ENG camcorder.
Whew,
so
say that,
a bit of a mouthful, yeah. So look, this is a typical sort of ENG running gun, fixed lens sort of camera. It's a 1/3-inch sensor, so you're not going to get the super shallow depth of field, but it's a 3MOS sensor, so you will still get decent colour, and apparently is meant to work reasonably well in low light as well.
If you look at the codex it shoots, it's very much about shooting the P intra format, so you can actually shoot at 100, 200 megabits per second, which is very high, but you can shoot in a way where it's very fast to edit with and there's no, you know, lag, which I'd argue these days, especially for the category of ENG cameras, that you'd want something that's faster upload, because more and more we're hitting the point where you film what you filmed and the producers want to have it back at the station straight away. And you're almost getting that sort of 10 megabits per second sort of speed that you can get it back to the station quite quickly. And if you've shot 6 minutes, that means you can probably get it back within 20 minutes from a laptop, which might be faster than actually driving back to your station. So
I would
argue that now you want to probably be going, I'm more interested in the codecs that are the lower bitrate and what they're doing to make the image look better on a lower bitrate.
22 times lens, pretty good for this sort of camera. You're going to get a fair bit of reach there or go pretty wide. It's not going to be a great camera for any creative endeavours, I wouldn't have thought, but for news,
documentary.
Just running and gunning and capturing an event, wouldn't use it for weddings or anything like that, I don't think. I just think you'd get a very video-y looking image, but if you're just looking to capture the moment, especially for news, I think this would be a pretty capable beast. Not 4K, only HD, which starting to get to the point where that might hinder it. But
if it's something where you're shooting and you want to have it shot in the bag, ready to go, it's got good stabilization with an optical image stabilizer. Panasonic's stabilization has always been very good. It's got ND filters that are easily dial up. It's the everything on the go camera, really. You can't go wrong with this camera necessarily if you're running around and shooting and wanting to get images without too much hassle and too much playing around. And I would also argue that with the battery life on this, I've got a feeling, and I can't confirm this, but it just feels that it's the kind of camera that would have a better battery life.
Yeah, I reckon it'll last all day.
Yeah, and Panasonic tend to do that. They'll release with their ENG cameras a camera that does have better battery life, and that's a big thing, because if you can get 4 hours out of a battery and survive, you know, with just a spare battery in your pocket for a whole day, that's really handy compared to the hour and a half, 2 hours you seem to be getting off some of the 4K cameras.
Yeah. Now, one hindrance, in my mind at least, is the media it's using. Using micro P2 cards, which I wasn't that familiar with those. We did a bit of research, and from what I can tell, it's an SD card with some extra pins. Yes, it has some more functionality, but I don't know. Geez, I reckon just use the SD cards.
They're $300 a card. And
For a
64 gig card. Look, if you're using this camera every day, three times a day or twice a day, and you're going to be getting maybe 400, 500 cycles out of your cards, if not 1,000 cycles out of your cards, then I would argue that maybe this is a good, safe way. It has like error detection and things like that in the cards on the fly. It is designed for a broadcast sort of environment in mind. But really, if you're paying $300 for a 64 gig card versus $80, $70.
Well, as I was saying, B&H a couple of days ago had 128 gig cards for $50. So
SanDisk.
Extreme models as well. So,
wow.
Look, I'd get the DVX 200.
Yeah, look, the one thing for this camera that would save it, in my opinion, is the battery life. And that is make or break. Sometimes, you know, if you want to be running around and have a camera that does run all day and you don't necessarily have the luxury of ducking back to your bag all day, maybe this camera has that in it. Until we see the specs and play around with one, can't really confirm anything. But, you know, form factor looks good. It's an okay camera. I wouldn't complain. I'd use this camera and happily run around with a corporate or something like that, just capturing content.
$4,500 US is listed retail. So it is similar in price to the DVX 200, and it really depends what you're after, I guess, in terms of a camera. The next minor announcement of the past week was an update to Lightroom, many people's favourite image, it's not really a manipulator, but a development tool for photographs. hasn't brought in that many new features. Mainly a bug fix release, but lots of new cameras supported, the new Canon 80D and 1DX2 and many others. Also fixes some problems that we had with the panorama feature, which was introduced in the last major revision of Lightroom. So there used to be some issues with the edges and perspective going a bit wonky. Adobe says they have fixed that. So nothing spectacular, but another feather in the cap for Adobe there. Today's big news is something to do with Blackmagic, Chris. Have you heard about this?
Yeah, I have. This would be to do with the delayed shipping of their latest 4.6K camera, wouldn't
it? And 4K, but interestingly, it's the 4.6 that they really seem to be focusing on. They announced this camera last year, and it's starting to become a... Well, it's not becoming. I think it is a bit of a running joke with Blackmagic, is they sort of announce something and then it gets delayed. I like Blackmagic. I have access to a lot of Blackmagic gear. I think they do some great stuff, but they do have their issues occasionally, and getting stuff out the door seems to be one of those issues. So they have finally started shipping the Ursa Mini camera, and it's a camera that looks like a good camera, and it has won pretty good praise from a lot of people. However, they just couldn't get it, the 4.6K version, out the door, and now they have, but they've had to sacrifice the global shutter function, which was one of the touted features when it was announced. So, Chris, do you want to explain to our listeners what global shutter actually is?
Well, yeah, global shutter was something that I always had growing up when I was filming, because I used to use CCD cameras. Basically, is when we shifted from a CCD-based camera, this is the image sensor, to a CMOS, but it would scan the image from top to bottom. So, of course, it's also known as the jello effect. When you rotate the camera left and right, you tend to get that sway of the camera, like, you know, going trapezoidal.
If you're looking at a pillar or something, the pillar looks like it's gone to jelly and it's swaying
on
like
an angle.
Yeah.
So if you swing the camera around left and right quite quickly, you'll notice that... yeah, objects in the scene look a bit rough. It's unfortunately has quite big repercussions if you're bouncing up and down or have, you know, even like a little bit of vibration. And when you start doing things like your post-stabilization, you see these really strange kind of effects, warping in the image. Yeah. You can save an image a lot easier if you capture the full frame in one hit, which is what global shutter is all about.
Yeah. So the 4K version has the global shutter, and they're shipping with the global shutter on the 4K. It's 4.6, apparently, the engineers had some issues with, and apparently they're still working on it, so maybe we'll see an update to this sometime in the future. But if you buy one right now, it's not going to have global shutter. It is designed as a cinema style camera, so perhaps it's less of an issue than it might be on some other cameras where there's more running gunning going on. However, it still would have been nice to get that global shutter.
And for as far as I know, the micro cinema camera as well didn't ship with it.
Yeah, same
issue.
So
they released this little tiny micro camera, think of something a GoPro size, that also has like good control.
Interchangeable lenses.
So it's a tiny little cube, which would be great for mounting on, you know,
drone cam.
Drones or anything like that. But if you're mounting it on a drone, you get that micro vibration. And really, those drone peeps really want global shutter. That is one of the big requests from them. So I think they've probably severed their ties with the drone guys a little bit by, especially the people who have pre-ordered them and then are going to get them and have potentially these vibration issues. But until it's out in the field, you don't actually know. It could be, and this is the thing, there's global shutter and then there's reduced rolling shutter effect.
Yeah.
Sometimes you can do what's called oversampling, where you might get 10 images for every image and combine them together, and it reduces rolling shutter. For instance, my little RX10, for instance, is still rolling shutter, but even in interviews, the person who worked for Sony said, oh, we've reduced it to the point where rolling shutter isn't really an issue. And it's true. It's not. I don't really notice it most of the time. It's very rare that it comes and bites me. It has to be something really extreme. So maybe Blackmagic have actually really reduced the rolling shutter effect.
Yeah.
Again, until we see it on the bench, and we only started shipping today, so maybe this is something somebody can confirm with us.
One thing I do like with Blackmagic that they tend to do regularly is release test footage straight out of the camera, and they've done that again today, and I think they've released more than they normally would because of the issues that they've faced. But this morning they whacked up just a couple of shots from a short film they put together. So you can download those on the website and have a look at them. They are quite big. I think one of them was 6 gig, one's 4 gig, one's 11 gig. These are just single scenes because they put them up there in full RAW. But I love that, that they're happy to go, okay, bugger it, let's put up an 8 gig file just for people to download one scene of raw video and mess around with it. And they've also put up a short film. They put up a behind the scenes of the short film, which is quite interesting to look at. And look, I watched the short film. I looked at the behind the scenes. I played with the downloads of the raw footage in DaVinci. And you get some nice images out of it, let's be frank. Like, yes, they've had their problems, but at the end of the day, you get a nice image and that's really what you care about.
Oh, and look, if we're talking about is this an upgrade from their previous cinema cameras, I think the Mini 4.6 just looks incredible.
Yeah, so that's the other big difference between the 4K and the 4.6. The 4K, you'll get the global shutter, but you won't get the dynamic range that you do on the 4.6. And the scenes they had in this short film, they've got, you know, a beach house where they're inside and they're looking out onto the ocean, so there's bright sunlight behind it, and you can see everything. The dynamic range is holding up, and you're getting the detail and the shadows, and you're also capturing the detail and the highlights, which I've got some of the 4K production cameras that preceded this, and the dynamic range was okay, but it was never brilliant. In fact, it was worse than the original 2.5K they released, so it's good to see them getting back to that high dynamic range stuff.
So for $5,000 US, really, you can't go wrong for a 4.6K camera. That allows you to
buy the EVF and the shoulder mount on top of that, and a couple of CFast cards.
Well, you don't need a shoulder mount if you're just going to put it on a tripod. Just
the shoulder mount, I think, was only $200, so it wasn't that big a deal. It's the EVF that is meant to be a very nice EVF, but I think that's over $2,000. So
does it have a little screen that pops out the side on the Mini, though? It does, doesn't
it? Yeah, not a little screen. It's a huge screen.
Yeah, so there we go. Well,
yeah. It's Blackmagic, though. It's just an iPad in the side of the camera.
So, yeah, you could basically run with just that camera and batteries that uses its own system, or VLOC, I can't remember.
You can get a VLOC mount.
Convert, yeah, that's right.
Yeah. So, yeah, looks like an interesting camera. I'm hopeful to get my hands on a couple of them. We'll see how we go.
But again, for more cinematic and more long form projects, I mean,
fiction stuff,
TV commercials, even YouTube commercials, specials, something where you've got a bit of time to process the footage and work with it.
Yeah.
Gee, $5,000, it's terrifying. And you don't even need a monitor, really, if you were to use this little one off the side.
Yeah.
You'd be better off, obviously, with this on-set monitor, but this would suffice if you needed it. So.
Yeah, exactly. All right, Chris, the next thing is something you found. This is a new action cam to compete with the likes of GoPro. It looks interesting. Tell us about it.
This is the Revel Arc, and I'm always a little bit skeptical of anything that appears on Indiegogo as a FundMe campaign. But look, it seems to be produced by a bunch of people who are quite passionate about creating a camera that allows you to sort of get a little bit next level with the way it films. Selling point is that it does rotational compensation. So if you're having something where your rotation is a big factor, it will actually keep on the horizon line and will do its best inside, I think, even with a certain amount of vertical and horizontal tilt as well, that it'll actually try to line the horizon up at all times.
Which, well, if it works, I think would be a good thing. Action cams tend to make me a bit motion sick, and maybe it's not even motion sick, maybe it's a bit more seasick, because you do get the horizon sort of going left to right, up and down, and that tends to mess with your inner ear a bit, I think. But this looks like it solves a lot of those sorts of problems. You're still going to get other problems, of course, but having at least one of the axes stabilized, I think should help a lot.
And some very interesting use case videos where they've got, well, one on a motorbike that looked quite good, where the motorbike was leaning right over and obviously, you know, the horizon would have gone all over the shot. Same with the surfer.
Yeah.
And you know, the background is actually flat at all times. So you sort of see the action of the person in front of the camera actually moving around a little less relative.
Lots of 360, well, they call them donut selfies.
Yeah. And there was a very interesting one where they actually mounted it to a wheel and were pushing the wheel along, and the camera was actually, you know, going with the wheel, but the camera inside was spinning 360 degrees and compensating for the image. So it was actually keeping a steady horizon, even though the camera was rotating 360 degrees consistently.
Yeah. I'm not sure that's a common use case. Well, to screw it into the middle of your wheel on your car.
But no. And the thing is, it's only one axis. So second view, and the camera, by the looks of it, only has limited movement on the other axis. So we'll see.
Also, if you hit a big pothole, what happens?
I don't know.
Yeah, anyway.
But it's an interesting product. It's called the Revel Arc, R-E-V-L Arc. And look, they seem to be selling an early bird version for about $350 US. And so I reckon it'll be about $400 when it comes out. Mm. They're saying they're very much pushing it as being something that you go straight to your phone and upload straight away as well. So it's going...
Because why would you want to edit stuff, Chris? No, why would you want to spend some time on it? Let's just whack it up on the web.
Whack it straight up on the web. So I don't know what the transfer speeds are or anything like that.
Hmm.
This is the kind of product you need in your hand to actually be able to review correctly. But it's coming out in December. So even though you can back it now and pre-order one, you're going to be waiting till December 2016 to get one.
Right. The next topic is something that's kind of boring, but also kind of important and does it affect us. It's DisplayPort 1.4. Tell us about that, Chris.
Just announced. Thunderbolt on the Mac, of course, has ability to output to DisplayPort. I've actually just lost my notes because the internet's gone off, so I'm just going from memory here. But so your kind of resolutions you get is that extended, you know, 2600 and whatever it is by 1600 high res, so that 2.6K kind of res at 60 hertz. That sort of resolution wasn't traditionally supported by HDMI, and I think still there's only a limited set of resolutions that HDMI can support, where the DisplayPort has always given you a lot more options, and it was the first to come to market with those super high resolution supports.
Indeed. Now, NAB.
Talking of things on display.
The most important time of year. It's Christmas for us, Chris. NAB, the National Association of Broadcasters. It doesn't stand for that anymore, but I'm calling it that anyway. It's a trade show, essentially, where manufacturers hawk their wares, for lack of a better description. But it's basically where all the new camera gear comes out. Not so much still cameras, more about video cameras and audio gear and jibs and cranes and lights and whatever else. It's an exciting time. It's happening in about 3 weeks from when we record this episode today. So, Chris, lots of stuff's going to come out. What are you hoping to see at NAB this year?
So, I'm hopefully looking out to see some stuff from Rode. I always get excited when NAB comes around. Rode are fairly new players in the NAB circles, and they release some fantastic wireless microphone systems called the Filmmaker series. And yes, they were sort of running on 2.4 gigahertz, and people who have used them have said really good things about them. Everybody seems to be raving about them. So
mostly.
Mostly. Yeah. And my, I guess, big thing would be to have a receiver that allows you to receive more than one mic at once. So you can put two feeds into your camera from one unit. Because the thing is, if you've got two wireless lavs on people and they're walking around, you've got to have two receivers on your camera. And sometimes it's nice just to bang a mic on two people and have them walk around and chat. Yep. In fact, I do that quite a lot when I'm filming. And I like to, you know, have both of those going to channel one and two. It just gets uncomfortable because you have to start clipping, you know, to the sides of the camera and it starts throwing the balance off and things. If you could have one unit with two outputs, you could do stereo as well. Rode have also hinted on their website that they're releasing a butt plug. And that's my phone agreeing with me, going, you said butt plug on air. No, this is actually a term in the broadcast industry for an XLR female that can plug into any microphone with an XLR input and turn it into a wireless device. Or you can go to a mixing desk and you can pop it into a mixing desk and get a feed that sends that. So it's like a wireless, but it's not a microphone, it's just a wireless plug.
Dongle.
A dongle.
Dingus.
Butt plug. And they have just sort of sneakily put that up on their website, so we're hoping that that's going to turn into a real product as well. I'm almost 100% it will.
Yeah.
That just completes the Rode range for me.
TX XLR, but you want that with multi-channel.
If I could have a...
Oh, you want the other end with multi-channel.
I want the receiver with multi-channel, yeah. That would, for me, seal the deal for swapping to Rode. I'm on Sennheiser gear at the moment, and I like it, but if I'm going to continue buying stuff, and I may as well swap over before I buy too much gear. I used to be Sony before Sennheiser, so I've got
all
three.
Yeah, so we used to be Sennheiser, and now we're over to the UWP D16 kits, which have the butt plug as well. And it's always frustrated me that you can't use both the wireless lav and the butt plug at the same time. You have to use one or the other. It would be great if you could have multiple outputs or some way of dealing with that because, yeah, it is a frustrating situation now when you do need more than one audio source, which is most of the time.
And the answer in the old days was, you know, stop being a tight ass, buy a proper broadcast camera, then you'll get this. Mm. But now, you know, there's no reason why we can't have it.
We've got digital everything, but we're still using all this analog audio gear. And it works, which is great, but there's got to be some interface we can come up with that will solve this issue. In fact, there are interfaces already, except most of them are proprietary. So if we could have some more intelligent way of doing this, apart from anything else, we could make it smaller as well. XLR is huge. It doesn't need to be that big anymore. We're treating our cameras not that terribly most of the time. We could probably get away with something that's a little bit smaller, still robust, but carries a digital signal.
Yeah, yeah, and a supplement. Yeah. I wouldn't want to replace the XLR
cables. Don't replace it. Just have another port.
I think Sony were trying to
stick Ethernet on the back of a camera and make it multi-purpose.
Well, Sony were trying to do this with their receiver things where they actually have the pins, a hot shoe, and with your receiver, you can put it straight on the camera and it pipes
it.
It was
the MAD converter.
Right.
I think it was MAD converter or something like that. It was some bizarre acronym that was amusing. But there's already these proprietary connectors out there. Let's do it with Ethernet, Chris. I reckon that would make sense. Stick Ethernet, and then you can run out a live video signal. What's the switching company?
Grass Valley.
Grass Valley. Not Grass Valley, not Blackmagic. They copied the toaster back in the day.
Oh, NewTek.
NewTek. NewTek are all about the Ethernet. I get a bloody email once a week about how IP video-based switching is the way of the future, and they're going to be showing it off at NAB. Why can't we do it for audio as well?
Yep. Brilliant. Oh, that's another thing I was going to say. Really want to check out what NewTek are doing. They've been up and down all over the shot in the last 20 years, 30 years, and I think it's NewTek's time to come back and shine.
Well, look, they've got some interesting products, and they do hit up the education market. They've got some cheaper stuff for universities and schools. A lot of their stuff has built-in virtual sets, and their virtual sets are reasonable.
So we're talking a blue screen background here, which will automatically knock out the background.
You get a box, and some of the boxes have a built-in monitor. They're not cheap. They're about $10,000, I think, and you can go up from there. But they have virtual sets, so you can throw in front of a cheap green screen, whack in a virtual set. There's even live interactivity, so you can do hand gestures to throw in lower thirds and all this kind of crazy stuff now. So they're doing some interesting stuff. It's an obvious end game. So, look, myself, in terms of NAB stuff, I'm looking forward to the roundtable discussions they tend to do before NAB. I always find those very interesting. Often, there's normally one from Creative Cow or moderated by Creative Cow, and they get in a few editors and people from the industry and chat about, what's happened over the last year and what they think they'll see.
I look
forward to that just as much as the event itself. And there's also the what used to be the Final Cut user group, now the Supercut user group or something like that. I'll just call it the Final Cut user group. It's the same sort of thing. It's something that's adjunct to NAB where people get together, and there's often some interesting developments there. In terms of a product, the Sony PXW-X70, which we've mentioned a couple of times on this show, it's a little camcorder. It's a professional camcorder. It's much smaller than most of the other things that are out there. I want to see a 4K version of that. Now, you might say, well, Jonathan, there already is a 4K version of that. You buy the camera and get the upgrade kit. I think that's stupid. Get rid of this upgrading bullshit. Sony has done it regularly. They did it with their FS700 as well, where you have to buy this extra stuff just to unlock functionality, and just release it with 4K, damn it. I think it's a very interesting camera. It's the right size. It's not a daunting camera to use. It has mostly manual buttons for things that you need to access. Doesn't have a ring for the iris, but it does allow you to switch between zoom and focus, and does have a dedicated iris button. So for a run-and-gun, non-daunting, reasonably cheap sort of camera, it's perfect, apart from the fact you need to pay an extra, $500 or more dollars to make it 4K or to unlock the 4K. So I just want to see a 4K version of that out of the box. No fuss, just release it, Sony, please. Anything else that you'd like to see there, Chris?
Not sure. You were talking about a Westcott Rapid Box. Is this something you wanted to see improved at NAB, or something you were looking at buying?
No, not at NAB, because it's already out. Just in terms of things I guess I've been researching lately, I tend to sit on the internet and have a look around at things to buy because I'm a nerd that way, yeah.
And you have a budget.
And I sometimes have a budget. It's part of my job to look at things that are going to be useful for people I work with. And the thing I've been looking at lately is the Westcott Rapid Box. For those unfamiliar with it, it's a soft box, a flash soft box. You stick a speed light in it.
It's a flash.
It's a flash.
It's bright when you hit the button.
It goes pop and, you get blinded. So you stick that in this little soft box and you get a nice soft light. The thing that is interesting about it, as opposed to all the $50 jobs you can buy, is that it's a umbrella-like design, so you can pack it down and pop it up very quickly. And that's great, because one thing with most softboxes is they're a pain to get up and running with. You know, you fold them out, they pop out, you have to sort of Velcro in some scrim and all this sort of stuff, and then you have multiple brackets that you mount and put it all together and mount it on a light stand and you're good to go. But it's pretty slow, pretty arduous, and the light quality, while better than a direct flash bulb, still leaves something to be desired. So this has an interesting design in that it has a beauty dish type function where you can add another, it's basically a concave hunk of metal. You put that in front of the flash, it reflects the flash back into the softbox, the silver sides of the softbox, and then that bounces through the soft front and gives you a much softer light with fewer hot spots. So I think it's something that would be quite useful for lots of photo shoots. I often use the f-stop as little fold-out softbox, and that's fine, but it's quite small. This gives you a lot more size. So it comes in multiple sizes. There's a 20 inch, which is the baby version. There's a 26, and I think there's a 36 inch as well. Wow. 36 is a bit pricey. The 26 seems to be the sweet spot. And I think that's a pretty good size for most out and about applications. You might go the bigger one if you're in a studio, but if you're out and about in a park or whatever, or doing a wedding, I think that would be the ideal size. So Chris, you might be carrying one of those around in your future.
No, it sounds like a fun little unit. People will say softboxes belong in the studio. There's no place for a softbox really out and about. You know, you just bounce off a wall or bounce off a reflecky or something like that. And you can, but I mean, that just means if you want to set up multiple units, if there was something light and easy which you could just carry, pop on the ground and then, you know, be done, that would be great. And you don't need two assistants and people holding reflectors and things. You know, this is where we're moving to. Everything is a little bit more lightweight and easier to set up and runs on remote, and it's all just powers up and goes to standby. And why can't we just have panels of light? We can just, you know, set up on a stand instantly and have ready to roll.
Yeah. And look, reflectors are great. I love reflectors. In fact, to my students, I'm like, before you worry about lighting, get a reflector and see if that does the job first and foremost, because they're such a versatile instrument. But if I'm shooting on a super long lens and then I want the light source to be nice and close, a reflector might work. But if it's, hey, it's a windy day, or a reflector is just not going to give you light because it's too much shade for whatever reason.
Or if you're at night and
at nighttime.
Honestly, it's really hard. It's easy when the sun's out and you can just get your reflector and go, there it is. And you're done. When you're at night and you're trying to bounce light off a second flash or something, it's just...
Yeah, it's tricky. And also, reflectors tend to blind your subject a bit.
Yeah.
So you end up with these people with squinty eyes and all this sort of stuff. So, look, the whole lollipop thing where you stick one of these softboxes on a monopod or a light stand or whatever, it seems a bit of a novel idea, but I think it's actually becoming pretty much a standard way to do things. I see it all the time now, especially with wedding stuff, because it's just a way to get the light in there, be very directional with it. You can get some honeycombs and stuff like that for this particular unit. They're pretty expensive, but you can get them just to control the light a bit more. You've just got that extra level that you can't necessarily get with traditional methods like a reflector.
Be great if you could put a nice little LED block in there as well and crank it right up and use it as a key light for doing film and TV stuff.
Yes.
It's a random thought, and I know it's a bit of a crazy one. I mean, there's obviously stuff that
works.
It has to
be a small light, though.
That works better. But if you could get something, those little CRI lights or something, you know, those super bright LEDs, and have that as your diffuser and just have a few of those bouncing on one side. There are other ways of getting light for obviously broadcast TV stuff, but that could be, if it was instant and easy to set up, that could be your, get into position, open the umbrella, hit the button, you've got your light that might only have a 20-minute battery life, but then you could just start shooting.
Yeah, indeed.
Be nice, diffuse light and people's wrinkles disappear.
It would be. So, look, I think I'm going to buy one for myself personally.
And just use yours.
You can just use mine. Yeah, exactly. Going back to NAB, though, Chris, anything else you'd like to see?
GoPro are talking about bringing out a drone. Mm-hmm. So maybe they might bring out their Karma drone and demo that as well. I'm in two minds about whether it's a good idea if the world needs a drone from GoPro. But You know, if they're innovative.
I think GoPro needs a drone from GoPro more than anything else.
Yeah. It could be an interesting move. Even something ridiculous from Zoom would be nice, like a F-16 or something like that, you know. Look, we've got the F-8 here today, which is fucking It's awesome.
It's got a built-in tone generator.
It's got a built-in tone generator and a built-in Slate mic, so you can switch to Slate mic.
Ooh, that's interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting, isn't it?
Okay.
So, I think Zoom's products have been fantastic. I reckon a really small recorder. You've got your H4 and you've got your...
You've got your H1.
Your H1, but just something...
It's plasticky.
Something that's really small.
One AA, so it runs out of battery very quickly.
Yeah, and the other thing with the H1 is it doesn't have an XLR in.
No.
So something really small that has two XLR ins and is like basically just two XLR ins and a little block. Something that can easily fit in your pocket or clip to a camera easily, like small little
unit.
Yeah,
I've seen a few of those devices, not from many name brands, but I've seen boxes basically, they're a box with inputs and you put them on your talent and then grab the audio later. As you mentioned, Chris, we have an F8 in front of us, which is a reasonably new unit from Zoom. It's a bit of a weird release, I think. They sort of trickled out, and they're hard to get your hands on. We finally got our hands on one of them. And look, to be honest, this is the first time we've used it. We decided to plug a couple of mics in and use it for the podcast today. So hopefully it's sounding better than the H4 from last week.
I spent a good half an hour playing with this thing. It's fantastic. This F8, Zoom F8, is... I mean, I'm already looking at the price thinking,
Before we get to what we think, what the hell is it, Chris?
So a field recorder is what you record your audio on. Typically, if you want to have more than just your straight two or four tracks of audio, more to the point, it's what you're going to be using if you've got a dedicated audio recordist on set. Now, traditionally, back when you had 16mm film cameras, they didn't record sound, so you needed to have a second person recording sound, hence your sound recordist. And they would have a little reel-to-reel player, usually made by a company called Nagra, strapped to their sides, which had very clear monitoring on the top of it. So you'd always be looking at, I guess if it's a sort of oblong shape, you'd be looking at the top of it, the top face. And you would have all your knobs to control your inputs, and everything was super clear and easy to see in direct sunlight, or it lit up at night, so you could see it at night as well. And that was the form factor which became the audio field recorder. Now, throughout the 80s and stuff, it all evolved, and we ended up with this company called Sound Devices, who made this incredible unit called a Sound Devices 744, and there was also an 8-track version. But this was a 4-channel recorder that basically allowed you to capture 4 super clean audio channels from lapel mics, from set mics, from boom microphones, and it ran on a standard Sony battery, so you could just clip it on and it lasted for like 9 hours of record time. Great unit. You also had the ability to run time code, so your camera could actually send exactly what frame it was up to, and it would pick that up and link it to the camera, so your images and audio in post-synchronization land would just automatically lock together. So these units are extremely valuable in the film and television industry, and their price reflects that. They were typically $8,000, $12,000 for these little units that strapped on your side and did the ISO, so the recording to 4 tracks or 8 tracks.
And even now, the Sound Devices especially are still $5,000-ish for that particular model.
Oh, for the 4-channel. And if you want to go to 8 channels, you're looking at $10,000. And Nagra, who did the original reel-to-reel one, came up with this unit that was... quite a big chunky unit, but had a big display on it with all of this amazing data with as far as metering, and it sounded the bee's knees. It's known as the audio recorder, but they're, again, $10,000 for a recorder.
Yeah.
Now, not everybody has $10,000 in their bank account, and Zoom recognized this.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, known for making their guitar pedals back in the 80s and 90s. I grew up with Zoom gear, and funnily enough, they're now in the broadcast game, and they brought out this 8-channel field recorder for less than $1,000.
No, a bit more than that, less than $2,000.
Less than $2,000. Yeah. How much did you pay for it?
$17 Australian.
Oh, I thought they were under that.
No.
Oh.
No.
But still cheap. still cheap.
Still less than half the Sound Devices.
Okay, I was about to say I'm going to buy one, but I'm not, because that's a bit more expensive now. But I'll tell you what's good about it is that it has the light-up LED lights per channel, so you can easily see, you know, what channels are receiving signals at a glance.
Yep.
Very easy, just hit a single button to pull up, you know, anything like pass filters or anything like that. You can instantly go in there and just be pulling off your filters. That's just a filter 240. Yeah, we go back down there again. But it's all very easy to get to. I just heard something there that I wasn't that impressed with. but it's, and I think even if you go into the PFL menu, I wonder if it's recording as well. Here it's getting a bit juddery.
Yeah, it's
I'd be curious if it's actually recording that judder. But you have the ability to change everything very quickly within a couple of button pushes. Nice bright LCD screen on it. And of course, if you get a bit angry and you decide it's a piece of shit, you've got the beep button as well, which is also used legitimately for
legitimately,
sending.
It's not just for swearing.
for sending signals down your line, so you can line up your audio to minus 20 dB. But it's a great little unit, and for under $2,000.
Yeah, I mean, under it's $1,000 US.
Okay, so $1,000, that's where I'm getting confused. $1,000 US is impressive for something that has 8 inputs and phantom power. So if you think about the practical use, you could run, receive 3 lapels, you could do an onset mic, you could do a stereo audience mic, and then still have something, maybe your comms or something like that, running as a
I'd
as
be
a
using
link.
It for panels when people are doing academic panels, when there's normally 4, 5, 6 people talking plus a chair, rather than lugging in a big mixer, which is what you'd normally need, and then dangling a bunch of wireless lapels off it. You could just plug it all into this and get your independent channels and do the best you can on the day and then fix it in post.
I reckon you could use this as a mixer.
You could.
If you had a PA system, you could just bang out, you know, because it has send, so you can send to multiple outputs with matrixing in it. So what this means is that if you had a PA system out front and you wanted to actually send a signal from this to front of house as well, you can do that. And if you've got audience mics that you obviously don't want to put from the front of house as well, like you don't want to have your people clapping and cheering, you know, coming through your main PA system, you can actually route a second output on this unit so it just sends certain inputs to certain outputs. 2 outputs on it. You can even send a different matrix to headphones.
Yep.
It's just got everything on it.
And you got two SDs as well, which is good.
SD cards. Yep.
Yes. Power supply options. You've got 3 power supply options. You can go through AA's. It's 8 AA's, so it will suck the AA's, especially if you're using all of your channels on phantom power. You can get an AC adapter, or you can use a 9 or 16 volt external power adapter. So if you want to get a big chunky lithium ion battery and just power it off of that, you get, you know, a day or two worth of power out of one of those. AA's, you probably struggle to get too much time, but hey, in a pinch, or as a backup when you've got it connected to AC, that might be the way to go. Physically, it's a lot more robust than let's say the H4 or even the H6, which was their higher end model up until recently. It feels pretty solid. Yeah, feels pretty good. Now, there is one definite downside to it. I think it's over on your side, Chris.
My phone? Well, no, I've figured that the phone only makes sound. It doesn't actually affect the preamps. It's only the headphones. It's actually the headphone signal amplifier that's doing it. So,
I was talking about this downside, though.
Oh, okay. So we discovered when we put a mobile phone on it before, it made some buzzing noises. But we have got another problem with it.
That's the bag that it comes. Well, it doesn't come with. You can buy it separately. And look, hey, it is cheap, so I won't knock it too much. I think it's under $100. But the bag is strange. Like, it's huge, which I kind of get because you can fit a pair of headphones in there, I suppose. But it's too wide. Like, there's a good 10 centimeters on the left or right-hand side of the mixer when you put it in the bag. So it just sort of moves about. And you've got pockets on either side of the case, so you don't need that extra space. I'm not quite sure what it's there for. Maybe I'm missing something, but
it seems that the bag is too big for the actual
strangely designed, I think. So
it was almost like they designed the unit with a different spec originally and sent that to the bag makers.
Got the CAD drawings a bit wrong. So look, the bag, I'd still buy it because it's less than $100, but I'm sure Porter Brace or someone like that will come out with a better bag and then charge $600 for it, but
it'll probably be worth it. Now, the question is, would I buy this over a Sound Devices unit? The question is, actually, can I afford a Sound Devices unit? The answer is that no, I would use a laptop and my Motu sound recorder for doing portable stuff, unless there was something that was around $1,000 that could just do it in the box. And this can, of course, it's about $1,500.
The Aussie dollar is going up the last few days. We're up to 76 US cents.
Hey, so I might buy one after all. But yeah. Look, $1,500 for a long battery life 8-channel recorder that's fairly robust. I'm I'm into that. It's pretty good.
Yeah.
Look, I'm the only problem I have with it is I don't, there's the menu knob, which is sitting in the middle of the unit, quite exposed. And you need that menu or knob to get to every single feature and make every single adjustment. So if you accidentally swipe that off or it got damaged, that would be the end of your audio recorder. The one thing that I do like about the Sound Devices units is have these little pop-in, pop-out buttons that are for your volume controls so that you can set your levels and then pop them in.
Yep.
And even though it's just a very simple thing, I think that's a very clever design. It's also a very flat front on the Sound Devices gear. The Nagra ones as well are just feel a little bit more solid, but they're bigger, a lot bigger.
One thing I do like on this unit, though, is the screen is pretty discernible outside. The H6 was the first one where they introduced the color screen, and it's pretty average outside. You struggle to see it. This screen is a lot better. It's still not amazing, but it's definitely a lot better than the H6 was.
But look, it's no Sound Devices. Sound Devices have these amazing arrays of LEDs that are so bright that you can see them in direct sunlight, no problem at all. Like, it's absolutely clean. This, I would say, outdoors, you might have, especially with the display on it, be having to shadow it a little bit sometimes to see.
Yeah.
It is reflective as well. Yes, it's got a little screen on it and things, but yeah, all the timecode options are there. I'm very impressed.
Cool.
Gets my thumbs up.
All right, Chris, so moving on to our beer for this week. And a big Australian name in the beer industry is Coopers. So we are drinking a Coopers, but not one of the more traditional ones. We've got the Thomas Coopers Selection Celebration Ale. What do you think of this one, Chris?
I'm just going to say drinkable.
Yeah, I'm not that impressed, to be honest. It's grown on me after the second one, but the first sip I thought, this isn't really as good as I was hoping. It's okay.
It's a drinkable beer. I could easily sit and drink this. It'd be good with a meal.
Yeah.
It'd be good with a steak. and when your review comes to that...
Most things are good with a steak.
Yeah, it's nice and malty. It's got... I'd say it's crisp on the back. I wouldn't say it's crisp. It's a bit sort of muted for me as a beer. It's drinkable. It's a nice beer. It's a step above your entry-level Coopers, but... Yeah. Yeah, if it was cheap and on special, I would buy a...
Yeah, it's probably more for the money. I think there's more interesting beers out there.
Yeah.
Yep.
But that's Thomas Cooper's Selection, Celebration Ale, with a guy with a beard so big that he's...
He must be a bushranger.
He's got to be a bushranger.
Mm.
No, he's just
Dr. Tim Cooper.
No, he's the current managing director.
Oh, okay. I think the dude with the beard is not the managing director.
Isn't he? I don't know. He says he first brewed his first batch on the 13th of May, 1862.
Probably not the managing director currently then. Cool. Wrapping up another episode of the Purple Fringe. Thank you for joining us. Next time we join you, we'll probably be in AB, and we'll have a shit ton of news to tell you then.
Absolutely. This has been a little interlude show, so I hope you enjoyed it, and we'll see you around NAB. Okay. I think we've just discovered another problem with the F8.
Is that the batteries running out?
I don't know what's going on right now. What the hell is going on? The levels really... I think it's a phantom power problem.
Testing 1, 2. I'm sounding a lot softer.
Yeah, right. Whoa, and it clicks when you turn the volumes up and down.
Is that...
No. Wow.
Yeah, Have you tried unplugging it, plugging it back in?
That was weird.